about the current state of affairs of web application security. And this is going to be a very dynamic conversation. You are allowed to ask questions. I have a microphone so I can run around like Jerry Springer. And hopefully it won't get that bad, although I know a few of these guys have some differing viewpoints. And I encourage the audience to antagonize them as much as possible.
Do not throw things.
Excuse me?
Do not throw things.
Oh, no.
Unless they're dollar bills.
Paper money only. Thank you. Was there a question already? I thought somebody yelled something out. Do we have the big security guards? Yes, we do. Do not attempt to test that theory.
They're hidden right now.
That's right. You can't see them.
Under the table.
Much like many security programs, right? We have security. You just can't see it. All right. Well, we're off to a really bad start already. So what we want to do is cover from different vantage points. We have product vendors, security providers, research, and researchers and such that can comment on corporate security standpoints. And I want to introduce you to QAP, the Question Answer Protocol. It is much like TCP in that there's a three-way handshake. You raise your hand, I acknowledge you, then you ask your question. However, it is like UDP. You're not guaranteed a response, okay? It is not a reliable protocol, but please do not blurt things out. We do have the microphone for those of you who are shy or whatever, don't want to speak up. You have your handy-dandy notebook, good for writing down clues and questions, and then you can just pass them up or whatever, and we'll read your questions for you. All right, so first I'll start off with a brief introduction for myself, and then I'll let the panelists introduce themselves, and then we're going to dig right in with a couple brief questions, and then the conversation is just going to kind of go back and forth between them. At any point, you can raise your hand and comment once you're called on, and that's pretty much it. Okay, so I am David Rhodes. I'm a principal consultant for Maven Security Consulting, provide services, web app security, pen testing, things like that. I've been doing web app security assessments, the easy stuff, since late 1995, early 96, back when the internet was young, just newly invented by Al Gore. So in dog years, I'm pretty, been around for a little bit. And that's pretty much all I have to say about Maven and myself. So I want to just briefly introduce by name. We have Caleb Sima.
Sima,
founder of Spy Dynamics. I was going to introduce by name, so that way I reinforce the fact that I know their names. Frank, Paul, and Jeremiah. So I'll just let them start off and give more details about themselves.
All right. I'm Caleb Sima, CTO and founder of Spy Dynamics. We're a company that makes an automated web application assessment product.
I'm Jeremiah Grossman, founder of White Hat Security. We offer a monitoring service for web application security on publicly facing websites.
Frank Lamb, not a founder, I'm just a senior manager at Deloitte & Touche, one of the big four accounting / consulting firms.
Paul Proctor, I am with Meta Group. I'm the token analyst in the group to comment on the vendor landscape, and things may get thrown from that end of the table. I did want to tell a quick story, though, that I started out my career about 20 years ago as a kernel programmer, I was adding B1 controls to a C2 operating system, one of the first rated Unix books. Who remembers the Orange Book? Yeah, so last night I'm telling this story at dinner, and one of these guys says, did you ever drop your punch cards and they fell out of order? I'm like, you bastard, when did 38 become old in the security business?
I thought you got into the security space after you saw Swordfish. That's what he told us last night.
Yeah, that was only after a couple drinks.
I have to say I'm a little disappointed. I thought you guys were going to throw in a little bit of how long you've been in, what got you started, something personal.
Okay. I've been in security for as long as I can remember. I've got my first PC. I've always been into this stuff. I love it. It's something I love to do. When I got into the web security space, probably around, I guess, 98 or so, and started figuring out the web stuff was really where I thought most of the action was, and I had the most fun. So,
I've been in web security for about 6 or 7 years, maybe from, you know, 97, 98 timeframe. Previous to founding White Hat, I was an information security officer for Yahoo, and all I did all day was audit web applications. I had probably assessed well over 300 websites so far. And one thing I'd like to say about why I chose this particular career is a lot of people think you could choose a career. This career chose me. This is what I do.
All right. For me, I started out as a developer for one of the larger body shops. Dropped into security back in 97. Started out at the network side. That get fairly tiring after 5 AMP network tests, I guess. Since then, it's been focusing mostly on the web apps.
So I was adding B1 controls.
All right.
Just wanted to add that I was founder and CTO of Syntrax Security. We started that as an intrusion detection company in the bubble. We sold it off into private equity, and in 2001, we all know what happened. So I work for a living now.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right, so I'm pretty sure we're all aware of what the problems are with the space. More and more news stories have people getting hacked, specifically through their web-based applications. Tower Records comes to mind, Guess Jeans, Victoria's Secrets, that website, as the headlines were, Victoria's Secrets website reveals a little too much because it was revealing order information, so you could see what a person ordered, what size they ordered, what color. And I don't remember offhand if there were credit cards involved. But anyway, these things have led to obviously loss of reputation, but also legal consequences, because the Federal Trade Commission, in the case of Guess Jeans and Tower Records, comes knocking on the door. Oh, look, it's the government. They're here to help. No, they were there to actually press charges, but to hold them their feet to the fire as to why they let consumer data go out. And did they follow best practice? And ultimately, the answer in both of those cases was they settled out of court and said, no, they didn't, or they could have done things better. So obviously, there's a big problem. The root causes will be obvious as we discuss, as we go through this panel discussion. So where I'd like to start off is the current state of where corporations are at. What are companies doing to address the problem? Are they even acknowledging the problem? So I'll just start off with.
Actually, I think Frank is a good person.
Yeah, Frank and/or Paul would probably be ideal to start it off.
Want to go? From a Meta Group, for those of you that aren't familiar with us, as an analyst firm, we get about 70% of our money from enterprise clients that essentially get a subscription to us. We get about 30% of our money from the vendors, and basically. The vendors talk to us to tell us what they've got. The enterprises work with us, and the main reason that the enterprises talk to us is because they want to know what everybody else is doing. So basically, my world is divided up into one-hour phone calls with people calling up and saying, excuse me, what the hell do we do about this problem? So I would say that fundamentally, application security, although there are a number of tools, I'll give a vendor landscape later. Where I can actually talk about the different layers of security that are out there, or the different application layers and where the different types of products fit into them. But fundamentally, we find that enterprises are still held up by not doing the basics correctly. And time and time again, we've got people that will call up and say something like, hi, I'd like to talk to you about what the best application security firewall is. And I'll say, well, what's your requirement? They say, our requirement is to get an application security firewall. And then we have to dig in a little bit more, and we find out that they have absolutely no processes. They're not paying attention whatsoever to the development of their applications. They're not doing any testing. They're not even looking at security as part of their development life cycle. So. These fundamental issues seem to describe time and time again what is wrong at the very basis of what organizations are trying to do. And then after they find out they've got all these problems, that's when they start turning to the tools and trying to implement those I would say that they turn to the tools first, then they discover they don't understand the tools, so they turn to the services second. And then they call us and say, what do we do now? And we say, we usually say start with some process first.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, some of the fundamental basics that that the reason why application security is this huge problem is the fact that, you know, you're dealing with a bunch of people who know nothing about security. You're looking at developers who really and have no history of knowing about security or even really doing a lot of care for it, because they're being pushed by marketing to release this this product out on a certain date, and then you push that out to a website, and you've got webmasters and system administrators who really don't know anything about security, and then you've got the security people who have in the past really been focused on network security stuff and identifying network flaws. So they put out this web stuff and they're like, well, we don't have time to, you know, reveal source code to look for buffer overflows or anything, but, you know, we'll just kind of stick it out there, scan it with a product and see if it has any vulnerabilities. No, it doesn't have any known vulnerabilities, you know, it's fine, and sort of walk away. So, you know, that's where the fundamental problem started, is that you've got all these people contributing to this thing that's really this hole in your network that that people are going through, and that nobody really knows anything about the security factor of that.
And that, so it's all the marketers' fault?
There's a lot of things that are marketing fault.
Are there any marketers here? Any people in marketing? Because I could talk slow and use small words if you.
It's too easy.
We got sock puppets. Marketing. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
I mean, I think from our standpoint, you know, if any, I'm assuming most people have heard of Deloitte. Deloitte's an accounting firm. We also have a big audit arm, which is sort of a big word people don't like to hear. When we go to a client look for application security, usually we go through a majority of our projects through audit, the channel. And the problem for audit has been that they have really no connection with the development group typically, or they're not on good terms with the application development group. So typically when we go in and testing, as Caleb was saying, we really are going in without not necessarily doing the right thing. It's driven from a reactive standpoint. All right, we need to test this thing since it's already out onto the internet. What do we do about it? The only thing from that standpoint to do is, all right, well, I can run tools against it. I could do pen testing on it. I can do app testing on it. But it really doesn't solve the fundamental issue. Is problems usually swim further upstream. So from a reactive standpoint, we see a lot of clients are relying on tools. They're blaming, oftentimes they blame the tools, saying, well, you know, I ran the tool said I was fine. And the people who are running these tools are not necessarily security focused.
Wait, the tool didn't find all the vulnerabilities?
Yes, it did.
Go ahead.
That brings in the question then as to, you know, like sort of what my theory and concept is that, you know, most customers don't necessarily see the tool as being a complete total solution. Although what a tool can do is identify 60-70% of, you know, the baseline of what's going to be out there and what's going to be found in normal cases. So when I look at my network and I look at the risk that I'm having to take and the amount of effort and money I'm going to put into my company in security, and I say, okay, well, what's good enough for me in order to make my stuff secure? If I run a tool and I can identify what most of these script kiddies or people looking for SQL injection holes or something similar to that, and I can plug those by using a tool and purchasing it cheaply, then that's good enough for me. And that's something that I can take care of and say, okay, I've done due diligence, I've looked at my app, my web application, and this is something that I've been able to do. I can eliminate 80% of those people. The 20% I know I can't completely protect myself against, but at least it's good enough.
Yeah, but that also assumes that they use the tools properly.
Right.
You know, they don't, you know, if I've got a secure development lifecycle, that might have tools as part of the process, but what they're doing is they don't have any secure development lifecycle. Some of them barely have a development lifecycle, but they end up just saying at the end, you know, throwing the tool in and saying, let's see what it says.
Right.
So in other words, you're absolutely right if they're used in the proper context.
Well, I think that's where Kale and I agree on a lot of things, that tools are a good thing to run, but I don't believe running a tool on your website is particularly due diligence. It's David up there mentioned Victoria's Secret and Tower Records. Tools weren't going to help those particular problems.
But
that is true.
But would they have helped with a lawsuit, though.
Would they have help with the lawsuit?
Yeah, exactly. If the authorities had come to them and said, okay, well, you're not doing due diligence in protecting your privacy or your information from getting released to hackers.
Right.
But then I come to them and I say, well, wait a minute. I've actually gone through and said, well, it services perhaps, but I've also run a tool that's specifically geared towards this issue that I've run. And their product claims to identify certain percentage of these vulnerabilities. I've done due diligence in order to prevent and fix my
problems. So would you stipulate that running a tool is due diligence?
No, wait a minute.
Well, I can't say that.
No, I just ask.
Okay. I can't say that, but I can say that I do believe that it does show initiative on the part of the company in order to solve the problem.
I have to agree with him. I just, by way of coincidence, I was the expert that the Federal Trade Commission called in to look at the Tower Record incident. Said, you know, what kind of security did they have? And I don't want to name names, Qualys, but they were running a network scanner. They were running a network scanner, and that I don't really think even makes claims to looking at web application security issues, or at least at the time they didn't. So ultimately, what I saw was they had no due diligence whatsoever for web app security. They weren't running scanners. They weren't doing code audits for security. They weren't doing anything, and that's why within 4 days of releasing this new version of their online record store, a non-technical, non-security person found the flaw and said, cool, I can see other people's orders. And they posted it, not to BugTrack. They didn't even know what BugTrack was. They posted it to some little forum about like records and music. Yo, check out what this person's, well, that guy's in the 70s, man. Look at his record list. Like, look what he bought. You know, so anyway, they had no history or no attempts. If I had seen them running at least even an automated scanner or something, at least it showed that they were trying. Would it have been enough? It wouldn't have been enough to prevent the problem, but at least it would have showed that they weren't completely negligent.
Yeah, but David, let's clarify also what the FTC busted them over. It was about incorrect claims in their privacy policy.
That's, yes.
And they said they overstated their claims of how much we protect your information.
That's right.
And then when the data was released, what the FTC actually took them to court over was the fact that they had overstated their claims. And then, you know, this whole concept of you know, is running tools due diligence? Well, there's a lot of gray area in here, and you want to get to the darker gray areas where you're running enough. And that line is called the standard of due care. And the standard of due care is really something that's only decided, now you're going to love this, at the time of enforcement. So at the time of enforcement is when the time when they're getting busted is when the government's actually looking at them, and then they bring in heavy hitters like David here to look at them and sort of set that level. And well, the government's going to make their case that sure, you had some protections, but you were in the white area and you claimed to be, you know, solid black and being very, very protective. And then of course the defense is going to pitch the case, look at all the tools they were running. So it's a more complicated discussion than, you know, if you run tools, you're doing due diligence.
Yeah, they overstated their policy, and ultimately it was a well-known issue that was intuitively obvious even to a non-technical person with no security background who found it so quickly that it was, is this really bad?
What did the FTC make Tower Records or make them do?
Some sort of nebulous thing about you will hereby have bring in the auditors. That worst punishment of all, bring in, no offense, but.
Yeah, they have to meet with their parole officer once every 6 months.
That's right. So they got off light. The biggest one I can think of was Victoria's Secrets was sued by New York State Attorney General's office, and that was a $50,000 fine and several agreements to do things in the future. And,
I believe it's 20
course,
years.
Is it 20
I
years?
I believe that they have annual audits for 20 years.
Ka-ching.
Is that number correct?
I got to give them a call. So, yeah.
But I think we definitely want to make a distinction. In the past, you know, all this is really talking about running the tools. I think the mentality has been that we're carrying forward the tools of network testing over to the tools of application testing. I think nowadays, from an audit standpoint, I would almost give some credit as, you know, that there's some due diligence done by running a network assessment tool. Because nowadays, network assessment tool has evolved to a level where chances are if the tool doesn't pick it up, there aren't much left for that. That remaining 20% is a lot more like 10% or 5% in my eye, on the network level. Now, on the application level, and people can disagree with me on that, but on the application level, I think the tools are you know, very specialized knives. It has to be wielded by the right person. You're just wearing the tool, you know, a clicking of a button doesn't really get you that level of due diligence because right. applications are so different.
Right, and actually what I want to talk about is services from your standpoint, and then everyone else can jump in because you get the inside skinny on what companies are doing. They open the kimono for Deloitte, as it were, and show you everything. Paint a picture.
Victoria's Secret.
So, you know, what kind of services are they requesting, and are those the right priority? And if they're not, and you try to educate them, what is the reaction?
We're seeing two sides. Deloitte, as a consulting company, is seeing what should be done. Deloitte, from the audit standpoint, seeing things done the not-so-pleasant way. From an audit standpoint, it's, again, very reactive. So what you're looking at is not the whole problem. You only look at the last mile of the problem. And, you know, with your hand tied behind your back, the only thing you could do is test it from almost as a user acceptance test, except yeah. now you're looking at it from a security standpoint. The application is a black box. So you're looking at it, how much can you test it? You can test it all you want. It's almost an endless exercise. The more time I have, the more likely I'll own more.
Paul,
how much does that cost?
Yeah. Endless. Paul, your customers you talk to, are they utilizing people to come in and do code review, things like that, static analysis of commercial products that they bought?
Well, you know, the services play, it really comes down to people calling up and saying, you know, tell us the best vendor to go to for a pen test. That's the way it always starts. And I say, what's your requirement for a pen test? And they go, our requirement is to have a pen test. And can you tell the types of calls I get all the time? But when it comes to the services for penetration testing, it really comes down to how far do you go? Because you can buy a pen test for as little as, I mean, if you're a big enterprise now, for as little as $20,000. Or you can just spend money at the big four, frankly, until you feel happy. And the biggest mystery, or like Vegas, you run out of money. The biggest problem that we see with this is people come into it with the impression, and seriously, this is, again, I think most people at this conference are on the brighter end of the curve, but I get the calls from the people who basically got the money. They don't really understand what these things are, and they say, I got to spend this, I need a pen test. And what they think they're going to get out of a pen test, be it application or network, and by the way, most of them are thinking network when they come into it, but right. sometimes mm-hmm. when they tell me about the apps, I point them down the app path. Yeah. What they think they're going to get is they're going to secure themselves by getting a list of all their vulnerabilities, then they're going to close all those vulnerabilities, then they'll be safe. So I have to walk them through the fact that basically the first thing that a service is going to do is run the tools, and then they're going to pick of the, you know, 100, 200, 4,000 things that it finds, they're going to pick the ones that they think, sorry, Frank, that they think are most easily going to be exploited, so that they can demonstrate that, yes, there are things that need to be exploited. We actually got in, whether you're doing capture the flag or black box or whatever, and they find certain things, and then they pop out of it, and they say, well, you know, we can spend more money to go after more of these things, but really what we've shown you is that you're vulnerable. And that ends up being the ultimate value of a pen test, is to show you that you're vulnerable. Yeah. It's not to close all the problems.
Absolutely.
So the big problem is the misconception out there in the market that's what they're for. And when we explain it to people, then we start talking about how much you should be spending on pen tests. And I actually had a guy last week who called up and wanted a pen test. This was a major bank trying to meet a GLBA requirement. And they had a requirement in their plan that said, we are going to run a third-party pen test every single year. And I said, well, what types of things do you need out of this?
A report?
It doesn't matter. We need a report. We said we were going to do this. So
no one's ever come to you and said, oh, we want to have our source code reviewed to make sure it was developed securely.
you know,
that's not a service anyone's really.
No, no, no.
I mean, up here,
it actually is, but I got to tell you, the people that understand that stuff don't usually call us to talk to us about those things because they have their favorite providers for doing those things. Rarely do we get the, let's put it this way, a pen test is something everybody's heard of, you can read about it, and they'll come to us and say, hey, what's this pen test stuff? We need to do it. Okay. If you're talking about secure development and code reviews, those are people that know what they're doing, and they tend to go out there and go with the people that they know.
And I've seen a pretty large pickup recently of source code audits and review. You see a lot more products coming out just recently doing source code analysis, and it's becoming sort of a big thing. And there are a lot of people pushing it, and I'm starting to see that a lot more. Along with that, and then now you enter in this binary analysis factor, and then people are starting to get confused, and they're like, oh, well, I need to do binary analysis and source code analysis, and then they don't really know what the difference is or what advantages to one or the other, but you're seeing a lot of that now.
Yeah. Have you seen anyone with plausible deniability? They don't really want a thorough audit because then they're afraid there'll be some sort of ethical requirement to go and fix what was found?
Only the ones that have done one before.
Only those? Okay. So the first time around, they're young and naive, and we're going to fix these. Yay.
I have to be honest with you. I don't think I've ever run into that being proactive. People don't really worry about the plausible deniability aspects. That they do worry about it on say the pen test angle, but on the code review, they're usually doing that because they're trying to become proactive and take care of the problems.
Jeremy,
I run into that. I won't say too often, but I run into it in small and mid financial institutions, especially ones with a number of websites. When we explain web application security to them, and you know, they say, well, what kind of results are we going to expect? And, you know, to make a long story short, you know, 5 to 10 vulnerabilities in the average website, and they start calculating in their head if they have, you know, 10, 20, 30 websites and it's going to take X amount of hours per vulnerability to fix, they go, wait a minute here, this is going to take a whole lot of time, and if we know about it, we have to fix it, so let's just wait on this a little bit until we figure it out.
All right.
I do agree on, yes, you know, the source code. We're definitely seeing more of it. People are talking about it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was from a plausible deniability standpoint that they shy back. Usually we get it from the wrong angle. So you get it from someone say, well, we need a source code review because now, you know, that's the next new buzzword to go by. Everyone's going for it. So what we have is now, well, instead of looking at my giant application, why don't you look at these couple snippets of my code? And look at snippets of code doesn't really get you a whole lot. And so from the person who initiate these projects, who's saying, well, why don't you just look at the interface here, the API is over here. The development cycle, the development group actually comes in and say, well, that really doesn't buy us a whole lot. You know, for this to really make sense, you actually have to understand how the access permission get propagated throughout our application. So, I mean, we've seen that. And then as soon as the person who initiated the project heard, well, if you have to look at all the code, then they start shying back.
I see.
So people have the right thought process, just the money becomes an issue. And the tools, I think that's one of the reasons why the tools are proliferating right now.
Well, the tools are sexy and easy to understand and at least nice right, little box.
Pie charts.
I mean, we saw what
it is. That's why we put them in there.
We all saw the movie Hackers, man. We know, you know, all the scanners and stuff.
And actually, our tool, if you download and use it, you have all sorts of Greek graphs and 3D characters.
3D characters, little dinosaurs and stuff. Yeah,
hacking by AutoCAD.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, the market, I think, is the main thing that's holding back. I mean, I would not go so far as to say these tools are mature. As a matter of fact, I would say, you know, far from it. But do they provide a value? Yes. The biggest thing that's keeping people from using these things is they don't understand them. They can't get the people that do understand them can't get the money to actually purchase the tools to start doing things right. Which is why we're seeing a relatively low penetration rate for application security. Period.
And vendor needs to do a better job explaining. And even for us, they can't explain it to us. And we're already more quote-unquote technical already.
I think right now the way that our products are working is that what I like to tell people is that we're at the current state and the way the technology is that we're finding 60 to 70% of the low-hanging fruit and the normal things that would take mundane person such as yourself going through and doing. But there's always going to be a 30% that has to be done that's manual because you're not going to find the real stuff, the real meat of application security problems.
Did you just call him mundane? I'm sorry.
The mundane stuff he has to do in order to, you know, for instance, if you're going through a big application, you don't want to go through and check every single parameter in an app for SQL injection. That's not something you're going to do manually. But with a product like ours, you let it run and it will go through and find SQL injection automatically on most of those parameters. So it eliminates that and gives you a nice top view of being able to say, okay, well, here's where I need to go, and here are some of my highlights in this application. The rest of it, you're going to have a 30% manual type of thing.
We got a question out here.
And by the way, the 30% that he's talking about, that's, again, what's holding them back, is the tool doesn't do the 100% that they need to do a thorough job. So if they can do the 70%, they don't have the skills in-house. So now they're looking at a services and a tool play. And
right. But it never will. The tool will never reach 100%.
Well, yeah. Especially when you have a lot of false positives, right?
Yep.
Woo! Okay, right. Hold on. We have a question. Go ahead. What's your question?
That's what the mundane statement, by the way.
Deloitte.
Zing.
It was not on there.
Script kiddies. Go ahead and say it.
No, senior person on the team is a 24-year-old senior.
I don't know if age really has a lot to do with the quality of work.
I've got that.
Well, if you're a CPA, it does.
Maybe if you're a CPA.
Let me
put a quick defense against that one first. There's definitely a distinction between what we do for audit versus what we do for consulting services. These things shouldn't be part of your audits, what our view is. And now bear in mind that I'm not from our audit side of the company. So that might be easier for me to say it. I mean, yes, I understand exactly what you're going through. A lot of those things, what we call general control review, general computer audit, they're not technical audit, they're not application oriented. And the problem, that is really the problem, that people are seeing it, well, let the auditor deal with it. Well, the auditor doesn't have access, first of all, the technical knowledge or the access to what should be done. So some of the process stuff you see, if done properly, that should be the starting point for the security.
All right, over here, this guy was over first. What's the question? Right. To rephrase his question, developers. Anyway, you're absolutely right. Well, I'm leading towards that. We're starting off with so I'll get back to that question. Was there another question up here in the front?
Quality standards.
Yeah,
the tools help.
That's a big one.
In an outsourced world, yeah, absolutely.
We've got testers who test things work right. We don't have testers who test things work wrong.
To make things work wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't go and test things work wrong, we just know it's right. So from a code review perspective, that's what we would want to have.
I think one key point, though, anytime there's outsourcing, money is always the issue. And usually it's the cheapest one wins. So cheapest ones also mean, outsource, security, afterthought.
Just a quick word, you would want to define your security requirements in the contract so that whoever's bidding against it understands they're going to be held responsible for, but you need a security policy first. What are you going to secure against what? Secure, totally secure? Right, so you have to define it.
Uh,
I have a brief little story. I have seen once recently a large aerospace consortium came to us and said, all right, go do this pen test for a collaborative environment where the engineers are going to be sharing schematics and such. They actually got the software vendor that they bought the product from. This is a hundreds of thousands of dollar piece of software because it did everything. It's a collaboration environment. They had them pay for the audit. They said, well, you know what? We're not going to buy your next release or whatever. And so when you're a 400-pound gorilla buying very expensive software, it's very easy to get perks and stuff added on. Just FYI. Anyway, there was a... All right, so if there are no other questions, I want to kind of move on a little bit where you guys... If you have any pressing thoughts, hold them. in regards to services, and Jeremiah and Frank, you guys do a lot of audits and such, like things like that. You have a whole posse, an underground lair of guys that just bang out web app scans and audits and security assessments. When are people asking you to do these assessments with respect to their life cycle? It's already in production, isn't it?
Mostly. The latest trends that we're seeing now is in a web application environment, since we target production websites more than anything else, we feel it's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
And usually there's a production environment and the staging or development environment, and we'll do all our testing, all our hardcore testing on the development environment as it's going, and perform periodic reviews or periodic scanning on the production environment, because they're not always exactly the same.
Right.
That's the trends that we're seeing out there right now.
And doing the staging environment protects you from disrupting production systems.
Exactly.
We're saying production systems. Major applications, they don't have the... They don't want to spend the money building a secondary infrastructure, so...
No, I meant we're in the life cycle, though. It's like, as in, we're our online banking...
Once it's rolled out.
Once it's rolled out.
So we're actually testing on the production system, but we get the 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. testing windows.
We have lots of those as well.
My first audit for a very large bank years ago was, we're going live with our online banking. What are you doing Sunday night from 12 to 6 a.m.? Because we're going live at 8 a.m. And there I was. I can't tell you who it was, but this is years ago. So it was kind of funny, you know. And then later on, 2 months later, when we did another follow-up, we found a big gaping hole. And it's like, oh, that was there the whole time. I guess 12 to 6 isn't enough. You know?
This audit
powered by Jolt Cola, you know. All right, so you're not really seeing anybody asking for it in development or in user acceptance testing before it goes live. I'm starting to see that, surprisingly enough. People are getting a good...
We do see them, but it's always like the last tick mark they need before they... Either at the right before the cutover
or... But it's not the majority.
We're the validation guys, the third-party auditors. We come in after the fact.
We see a lot from a product side, though. I mean, all of our customers are asking how to push it from production into development to QA. Well, so every single customer that we talk to, anytime... They do a scan of our product or something like that. The first thing they do is meet with the developers, meet with the QA, and they ask us, how do we get the developers to do this and how do we get the QA to do this?
Right. I mean that's one of the uses of the tool is to bring it in to test as you go.
Well, and I think the point was made earlier about the fact that this stuff doesn't ever make that it's two different groups. You know, you got the security folks that care about security and they've got one tick mark in the development life cycle and it's at the very end, you know, 2 hours before you go live. And the thing is that if you try to get the developers to actually address this issue, they're in a different group and they are rewarded based on their ability to get things out on time with as much feature and functionality, and that culture is not going to change anytime soon until those people start getting rewarded for having not bug-free code, meaning the feature doesn't work, but vulnerability-free code, and developing those types of metrics. You're not even going to see the beginnings of that cultural shift.
I also think it also holds to the fact that developers and you know are generally, in my opinion, you know, it's hard to do security in an application and code it properly. And I think that if there's a way for developers to help them do something securely, like today, solutions to web application security problems are always giving the developers more work. I either do an audit from you guys, and you guys turn over a list of problems developers have to do more work on. I run a report, I guess a product, I turn over a list of more things. Source code analysis. Source code analysis, same thing. I find all these points, I give developers more work to fix. And I think when we come up with a solution here that helps developers code more securely, that's when you start seeing that start changing. Because then it becomes a requirement and developers are still gonna not like it. It's not gonna be something they wanna do. But once you can start giving developers a way to ease the security implications of being able to do this, a much easier route, I think that probably will help a lot too.
So this kind of ties into the comment earlier about, I mean, I would have to agree with the question was, it was kind of a leading question almost, like, I don't know how you could disagree with it, is ultimately we have to get to the developers early while they're still like in kindergarten, you know, and teach them to, you know, do things right. And that leads to training, you know, send them the black hat. No, and I don't get any. But, for saying that, but standards and secure programming guidelines, where are these? Go ahead, you were going to comment.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, it's, I think ideally that's great. I think that giving developers education and training them early is the right way of going about doing these things. But you're looking at, you know, millions and millions of developers today that are coding these applications that these companies don't have the money or the time to go through and educate these developers about this.
The code's already out there. So.
Right. Well, I mean, even then, they just, you know, when you go to a large company, plenty of customers I've talked to deal with this, and they've got 1,200 developers, and each of them are groups working on separate pieces of this app, and they're like, sure, I understand the theory and philosophy of educating developers, but it's just not going to happen. It goes, we don't have the money to send them to training, and we don't have the time. We need to get these problems fixed now. How do we go and do that? Right. I can't sit there and hand over all of these bug sheets to these people. And that's why developers are pushing back, because they're saying, you're giving me all this work, and I've got deadlines I've got to meet. It's just not going to happen.
So. I've got a metagroup thing here that actually talks about the costs at four different phases. If you catch a bug in design, implementation, test, and post-release.
Microphone.
Repeat. Design, implement, test, and post-release. The variable costs or the incremental costs. If you catch a bug in design, that would be your unit one. If you catch it in implementation, it's 6.5 times the cost. If you catch it in test, it's 15 times the cost. And if you catch it in post-release, it's 60 times the cost of if you'd caught it in design. So, I mean, I know there's been a number of studies about that, and you can, you know, the numbers are fungible, but
those are QA metrics, pretty much.
What type of those costs there? What type of software does that represent? Shrink wrap software or application software?
No, this is specifically talking about application development. Yeah,
okay. And not necessarily security flaws, just flaws in general.
Those are QA metrics.
No, this is applying security. At various stages.
Does that take into account possible legal consequences and loss of reputation?
No,
it's not going to capture those. Okay. It's going to capture just the cost for fixing
those
the problem.
Metrics are pulled straight from QA. I mean, it's the same thing. QA goes around and they say, these are my metrics. It's a proven theory that these metrics, you save more in design and you do in production. All you're doing with security is the fact that all a security defect is just another bug.
That is an excellent point, because a bug is a bug, whether it's a security vulnerability or a feature not working. It's something that is unintended. It's coding something that causes something to happen that's unintended.
The thing is, I'm not buying the. I get that catching the bug earlier in the development life cycle is less costly, but I'm not buying that it's the same for shrink wrap software versus web application software. It's two different life cycles. When you're doing shrink wrap software, you have to test on a variety of different operating systems, a variety of different machines. You have to print CDs, update the manuals, and ship. Web applications, you got your web servers, you code a change, and you push. It's got to be different.
But I honestly believe that these numbers are accounting for web applications, because I know that this number in post-release for shrink wrap software is astronomically larger than 60.
So there's got to be a difference there. You just can't go, this is QA, this is bug cost. It's got to be a difference between shrink wrap and
there was
web
a question out here in the black shirt.
I mean, our whole product line and our company is geared towards that. Our product line is, we have an assessment product for security people. We have an assessment product that's integrated in Mercury Interactive and QA tools that QA people are using, so that when they scan for stress testing, functionality testing, they're now scanning for security testing as well. And we're also coming out with development tools like secure component libraries that we're giving out to developers that help them do input validation, so that it helps, you know, the developers code more apps more securely. So that's our whole product line. That's what we talk about the entire time.
From our side, we definitely tell the client, I think more so for, even to the point where sometimes we turn down work, saying that this is not the right way to go. We look at it from their budget standpoint. You know, we shoot ourselves in the foot every now and then, but we just tell the client, look, this is not going to buy you what you need. We don't want to be a check mark. Especially when we have a relationship with these clients. Yes, I can, you know, make a small fortune for the partners, but that doesn't really, it hurts, it damages the relationship in the long run, because we're going to give them reports. It's going to be like those audit reports you see. You know, we run the tool, here you go, here's the low-hanging fruits, enjoy, knock yourself out. That doesn't really solve the problem. You know, next year we'll come back, all right, problem round number two, same thing. It for us is, we do tell them, you know, whether they're receptive to it or not. We do, you know, because when we tell them these stories, people don't like to hear these things. So, you know, we a lot of the time they end up going to a smaller boutique shop saying, oh, well, they said they can do this for me for $30,000. You know, whereas we might quote a much higher price. But I think that sort of further feeds the problem, that people think, well, I've had a third party do it. They might not be doing it right, because just from a monetary standpoint, some people are just in it to make a kill and then move on.
And we definitely, from our perspective, pound on our enterprise clients regularly about this, but I make a joke out of it, but seriously, I get the call saying, we need the tool. I say, what's the requirement specifically, so I can start backing them up in, well, you're trying to secure applications, right? Well, let's start back at the beginning of the life cycle when it's cheap, and we start telling them that, and they go, you know what, that's fine. I got $100,000 I got to spend on a tool. We failed an audit. I got a requirement. Just give me the list of tools and shut up. So that's the problem. We're telling, they're not listening, for the most part.
I mean, I think it requires a bigger paradigm shift in terms of how this stuff is going to have to be thought out. And, you know, the training is great, but, you know, if the process is not in place, what good is training these people? I mean, the company doesn't really support that development cycle from the get-go.
So what are they supposed to use as far as a resource when they're looking at their, what, you know, what are they, is there like maybe a top 10 list of some sort that they could go up against?
You tell us. you tell us, Dave.
Yeah.
But let me get this question in the back, and we'll just let that fester.
I'm gonna try.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that Bruce Potter? Yeah, I'm sorry. Are there any other questions? Who let the schmooze in here? I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead. That's why we give kids safety scissors, right? Okay.
You raise a really good point that web apps, for the most part, until the emergence of these frameworks, it's been the wild, wild west. Do whatever you want, do it as quickly as possible, and get it out there. So that's an important first change. I mean, if you look at the way shrink wrap software, you know, has been developed in the past, that's certainly become more structured, at least in some companies. That has not been possible to put the types of controls around it, so now it is. So we're at the front end of the cycle for training people to be better. I'm not sure I agree with you that we're just going to lay these frameworks over it, don't train them, they'll, you know.
Well, it's a combination.
It's a combination.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, when you're going to take a look at the scenario of you've got 1,200 developers, you need to fix problems now. What's the easiest way in order to do that? And the easiest way is to do that is to make it easier for the developers to do it securely. And so you need to have some sort of component or framework, like he was suggesting. Like, for instance, when you talk about web application vulnerabilities, my theory is that 80% of all web application vulnerabilities can be completely demolished and vanished by developers doing a single thing, and that's input validation on their web apps. If they look for a social security number or a phone number, and they expected it, and they didn't do anything, and then they accepted it in, you can eliminate a lot of these vulnerabilities. And if you create a framework or something for these developers to use, it's easy for them to do things like input validation, then you can help solve a lot of these problems with a very little amount of time and a little amount of resources in order to do so.
Well, even if developers were perfect, there's still, you have to actually implement something and configure it, and you know, stuff happens. So,
and there's also the different solutions. If the solutions are different, if you have existing code versus code that hasn't been developed yet. Training is good for code that hasn't been developed yet. But as Caleb said, if you have to get code fixed now, there needs to be a different solution besides education.
And I guess we should state clearly that there is no such thing as secure code. I mean, you're never going to be at 100% no matter how hard you do this.
I write
100%. We can't even get the stuff to work, let alone be secure.
We were talking last night about buffer overflows in Hello World.
Right, that's right, right.
All right, were there any other questions that we're about to move on to something slightly different? But yeah, go ahead.
It's a Sev1 bug at that point.
I mean, there's severities. I mean, even if from a non-security standpoint, you know, if the bug somehow depletes your account because of a decimal calculation error, that's still a bug. It might not be a security bug. So it's a severity issue, I think.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We'll ask this guy in the front here. Yes. Well, no, actually, we're getting into talking about secure programming standards and educating developers and giving them the tools and standards which really aren't there yet. But so we are getting there right now. In the red shirt.
I got to do the logical box thing one more time.
Okay. Sounds like a song.
You get into the but availability issues aren't typically categorized as security issues. And if you look at any structured programming environment out there, then you look at the tools that they might have for supporting their development lifecycle, you'll always see places to check off severity and criticality and so forth. But do you ever see a checkbox for security relevant? There isn't. And I think we don't disagree with anybody out there about what you're saying. And when you start getting into service level agreements, absolutely, we agree with that. We're just commenting on the state of the way development is done today and changing that culture into something that does care about security. Because frankly, if it did care about security, it would be as both of you describe, it would be, you know, security bugs would be treated as something special. And right now they're just not.
Is there another comment? No.
Oh, I just wanted a thing besides the fine was one thing for these corporations, but it was the, you know, as Paul might have mentioned, you know, many years of audits were much more costly than the $50,000 fine.
Okay, so one of the keys to prevention is to know what you're trying to prevent, right? And so we're talking about giving developers technologies that are intrinsically more secure, but yet still educating them as well, and using audits and scanning tools and such. But as far as developers and making secure code, what kind of checklist do we have? And this goes to the top 10. And it's up on screen, by the way, in case you... So this is the OWASP top 10, and I'm sure we're all familiar with it. What's wrong with this? Isn't it good? I think it's good.
No, all right.
Isn't there another top 10 list coming out, or is it 10, or is it going to be...
It's not top, it's just... There's the Web Application Security Consortium, which Caleb is also a member, is a categorization of the threats to a website. There's 6 categories and 24 classes of attack that we're able to do. We have not yet categorized them as far as how they
priority.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, if you take a look at the top 10 list and you take a look at number 1, unvalidated input, but then you take a look at number 4, cross-site scripting, and then buffer overflows, injection flaws, you're looking at input validation problems, but I don't really... So where the categorization problem kind of lies is, okay, well, unvalidated input is an umbrella cover for a lot of these issues. So what is it that you're really looking at?
I think what Caleb's dancing around here is that list is terrible.
Okay. Well, there you have it. So, all right, well, okay. There's another top 10 list coming out,
list.
You know, insert number here.
It is
a categorization. Tell them briefly what it is.
Well, first of all, IDS for web application security is tough to come by and exploits. I mean, we only have a handful of documented attacks, like guest genes and tower records and things like that. I know what I find in web apps. Frank here knows what he finds in web apps. Kids and Caleb knows, but there's no central repository for knowing what vulnerabilities end up in what apps, so we can even dream up a top 10. There's no bug track, there's no CVEs, there's none of these things. A top 10 is a fallacy at this point. We know how we attack web apps, and that's about it, and that's what we've been classifying.
Well, I mean, there's two different things. You know, we're talking about classification, but that's sort of a lot different than what the top 10 is.
Right.
When we're talking about the top 10, you want to say, okay, out in the real world, what is it that are the number one vulnerabilities that we're seeing out there? You know, what are the top... Really, I can't even think of a top 10. I can think of a top 4, maybe.
Right.
At max that you can come up with. And we're discussing a little bit about this. When you look at, you know, things like buffer overflows being on a top 10 list and custom web application attacks, we just don't see how that can even be on there.
This is one of the questions. You guys are testing lots and lots of stuff and just sheer volume. What are the most popular things you're seeing? And or what are the more popular things that you know people are actually getting attacked with, which are kind of two different issues. You can find stuff, but nobody exploited it. But let's start with you. You've got a lot of.
I have a tough time. I really don't have really good data on.
Just make it up. Statistics off the spot. Go ahead.
Oh yeah.
Well, number one is SQL injection. I think we see that the most often, the most common. You'll see it everywhere.
Which one?
SQL injection. That's rated as number one due to the severity, because it actually is a severity. It is a severe problem. Cross-site scripting, of course, gets found everywhere in every app. I think Jeremiah was telling me how they were having a contest and how fast you can find a cross-site scripting bug in a web app, and it's like 26 seconds or something. You know, and it's like you can find it. You can find cross-site scripting any web app anywhere. But isn't cross-site scripting necessarily dangerous? Is it something that really?
It is to the end user.
Cross-site scripting to exploit client vulnerabilities.
Right.
But the fix is Firefox. All right, good.
Here's the thing. Is cross-site scripting, yes, does have some danger level, and especially with the recent rash of phishing attacks that are coming out there, cross-site scripting gets a little bit more up in severity. But when you start claiming cross-site scripting as being in a top 10 list of exploited vulnerabilities and web app problems, I tend to see a problem with that, because I don't see a lot of people exploiting cross-site scripting in web apps.
Well,
it's a problem.
How are you going to see it, though?
Well, the phishing scams, though, you do see it a lot.
Yeah, there's only like one or two of them that actually use cross-site scripting on a web server phishing.
Yeah, but that's
most
thing.
Of them use browser hiding the URL exploits.
Yeah. But how would you ever see it there? I mean, we have no logs. How would you ever see a cross-site scripting attack? I mean, if you get an email in your favorite webmail client and it exploits, there's only two people that know about it. and it's the hacker and the user. Right. There's no logs there. I mean, how would you ever see it?
Let's just take at the most popular phishing attacks that come out there that you see in the news or that you see coming out in the list on, you know, the top areas of where, okay, these guys are doing phishing scams. And you take a percentage of that and say, okay, out of these phishing scams that we're seeing, how many of them are
cross-site phishing? That's news versus what's actually going on.
I understand that. But you know, you can't really justify that. But do you really consider cross-site scripting being up there with SQL injection?
It depends on the instance. Like you said, not in severity necessarily, but I've seen some very serious cross-site scripting for So
that's it. Sort of comes into play.
I've seen SQL injection where the database is crap.
I've seen that too.
SQL injection is also the same thing. There's a lot of problems I think where it comes into saying, well, cross-site scripting is being a huge problem. I'm sick and tired of seeing bug track postings of cross-site scripting in every single damn web app known to man.
Why don't we just post the ones that aren't vulnerable to cross-site scripting?
Right. It's just, you know, every single day you see some new, you know, third-party shopping script thing with cross-site scripting.
So to back up a little bit, we see, you know, there's probably three major issues out there that, as far as volume of vulnerabilities that are taking up. That's why, as Caleb said, we agree on this point. There might be a top five, but it's more like a top three that account for 75 to 80% of the vulnerabilities in web apps.
And you've got, I think we named them as SQL injection being a number one. Do we even count cross-site scripting?
As far as number of vulnerabilities, yes.
I would, because it can be serious. It depends.
And then session hijacking or session prediction. As we like to call it, to where you're able to change the cookies and be able to manipulate and grab customer data.
Right.
And we see those as being like the top vulnerabilities that we're seeing in our field as what we see most often.
I might have found a buffer overflow once in my life via a custom web app, and I certainly didn't exploit it.
Okay. One of the comments or recommendations would be don't roll your own session management, right? As somebody mentioned that the other night. Are you seeing that more and more, that people are making their own session tracking the mechanisms rather than using what's built into Tomcat
Folks, stop coming up with like special cute way of managing your own sessions. I've seen session cookies that are just horrible. I've seen someone squaring the system time. I've seen for a healthcare, a cookie that have your social security, your primary doctor, your customer ID all rolled in four-character shift.
Was that for a 401k provider?
Not a 401. It was for health benefits, which is even better. And then when you confront
I've seen
them,
that too.
You know, and this is where I think that training thing comes into play. We confronted them. They say, well, our cookies is encrypted. I'm like, what is your definition of encryption? Well, you know, apparently it's like, it's not clear text. And we're like, well, it's a 4-character shift. And they were like, well, you know, normal people wouldn't see that. And obviously you guys are technical. That's why you guys picked it up. And we were like, well, okay, but it's not that difficult to see. And their view is, well, if someone who's this technical actually finds this out, they obviously should be attacking banks, not, you know, healthcare providers. So, I mean, it's just the awareness concept. It baffles the mind. But please do not create your own session. Or if you do, come up with something a little bit more complex than
triple base 64 encryption.
Double rot 13.
Something with an acronym would be nice.
Do a 5-bit shift, they'll never expect that.
We see a lot of that, and when we talk to customers a lot of that times, is the reason why this occurs is because they had a base application that was coded this way a long time ago, and they've built on this web app with newer technologies and newer things that included this handling, but the session stuff just never got turned away because it was the core of their app, and they just kept building on it. So they've got this, you know, this app that they've just kept building on and building on. They've never had time to go through and fix it because that would break everything that went through.
Well, I think it's also a certain level of elegance. I think people are, you know, programmer likes to minimize, reuse as much as they can. But session ID is not something you should be sharing its purpose with anything else. You know, session ID should be just that. You know, session ID shouldn't embed data fields, and there's absolutely no reason to. There's plenty of fields you can go with. You can create new additional things to deal with, but not on your sessions cookies.
All right.
You feel strongly about this, Frank?
Do we?
I've been beating people.
Wait a minute. It doesn't matter, though, because they have an application firewall. That'll protect them.
Yeah. Oh, don't even start on that one.
All right. What? Okay, I'm right there.
Question about sessions across multiple web servers, single sign-on. Do you have any recommendations for that?
integrates single sign-on. The only thing I've seen people using single sign-on is a literally to consolidate user IDs. Anything above and beyond that is complete waste, which is unfortunate. If you think about it, once you have built a single sign-on infrastructure, you should be able to leverage it from an access permission within your application. But rather, all I'm seeing single sign-on being used is literally the front-end authentication only. Everything behind that is surrogate accounts, no accounts, everyone see everyone else's stuff. So once you get past the first single sign-on, the rest of the value proposition of single sign-on just completely wasted. So you know, once you log in, great, you get your regular web screens. Well, then you just start flipping your user IDs around, up and down, shift it up and down, and you see everyone else's stuff. So I'm not sure I understand why people spend the money on single sign-on, but then don't use it all the way through and just use it at the last.
Well, actually, I can answer that, because they get their seed money for doing the front end stuff, and they get that money based on all the back end advantages, and then after they instrument their first app in the front end, they don't get any more money. They said, well, you're supposed to get all these advantages. Well, we can't fund you to instrument any more back end apps.
Quick time check, 9 minutes, and we're standing between them and lunch, so.
Oh, sorry.
It's an ugly looking crowd.
So were there any other questions or comments? I mean, there's a whole more bunch of topics that I wanted to start rambling off, but maybe a lightning round of what's currently out there for auditing and protecting or securing web apps, and what's good and what's bad about them. Application firewalls, good or bad? Are they ready for the real world?
Not ready. They're good in the development environment. You can get them really secure, really configured the first time. 3 months later, if they're in block mode, actively blocking IPS mode, they get really difficult because the application changes and the rules of the firewall have to change with it. So, in a normal case study situation, the application firewall will be turned off and simply go into logging mode. And that's usually how I see it play out.
Does anyone here have a bad experience with app firewalls being hard to configure? Nobody. Well, there you go. How many people have an app firewall? Ba-dum-bum.
That's a good topic.
You're the analyst guy. Is there a big market share for this? I've only encountered one customer, and it was this little rinky-dink customer, which you wouldn't think they would have all this elite hardware, and it was like bulletproof. And it's like, by the way, nobody wants to hack this anyway, so why are you going through all the trouble?
They had intrusion prevention
and everything.
In a word, no. I mean, if you want to get to ultimate layers of security, it's something you can add. I think that they have incremental value, but they are hard to configure and they're costly, and that's why they have such low penetration in the market.
App scanners, the end all be all, right? They just, right? Four step methodology.
Hey, don't ask me, because I'm unjilted. So.
We got the big four's four step methodology, right? Point, click, print, and invoice. So, or no, wait. First you invoice. Then you point, click, and print. There you go.
Hey, David, let me do my eight layer model here on the, because this kind of explains all the different areas where you can throw security in there. We've got we actually divided up all the layers from web services down for applications.
Is this something that you can put somewhere or whatever?
You know, we talked about that beforehand. I'll just read it off. If anybody wants it later, give me a card. But basically, we start out at the top with service composition, where you've got web services choreography, coordination, reliable messaging. You get down to let me read you the layers first. Service composition, federated trust, SOAP security, XML security, app level security, and then you get into the OSI model, session level transport and network. So this is all the different places where you can actually add security. So up at the top under service composition, again, you got web services, choreography, coordination, reliable messaging. When you get into federated trust, we're talking about, now by the way, this is different tools, techniques, and standards. So we've got the Liberty Alliance, MS Passport, SAML, and Web Services Federation. Down in SOAP security, XKMS, Web Services Secure Conversation Policy, Security Policy, Trust, Privacy, and Authorization.
Wait, what was the question again? I've actually forgotten. What are you describing?
I am describing all the different layers in applications where you can add security.
Okay.
Go. Do you want me to stop?
Yes, I would. I've totally. Well, I'm trying to think. What would the takeaway be for the person in the audience? And they're like, hungry, must eat. So,
well, you know what? Let me go to a much simpler one. I'll tell you where the vendors are.
Yeah, last round of questions. Come on, you got 5 minutes. The same people are asking questions. It's good, I guess. The rest of you are mooching. All right, you're in the front here. Yes.
I'm not sure I agree with that. Input validation is a fairly specialized thing to do, perhaps. I'm not convinced that it's that easy to just roll a toolkit that just does your input validation for you.
Yeah, which is a very good point, and that's I'm getting into a product pitch here, but that is why we have gone through that whole process and created a product that we call Secure Objects, and it works for .NET right now. That is an input validation blacklist and whitelisting routine that basically we put in a lot of effort and work into, and it's kind of cool because you can go in your .NET project, identify all your external inputs in your source code in your web app, and immediately say where it is and validate it. But you're right, it's a difficult thing to do, but it's something that seems to make sense to me. So that's something that we created to sort of help developers go through. It's .NET developers right now, and actually use it to validate their input properly. And that's probably why it hasn't been done.
The way I see it, can't hurt.
Right.
Okay. Was there...
Right here.
That's right. How do you validate your services? What are the requirements to hire, to bring in talent to do this? What are the...
Every client should have some form of interview process with your testing team. And this goes for even for the big fours. You know, if you don't, you will get a different set of people.
But what is that? What is that interview process?
Ask them, have you ever hacked a Gibson?
You definitely want to tie in your development team in the interview process. Your security guys, along with your development team, should be tag-teaming these interviewing just to make sure that these people who are, if you're looking for them to help you with your development lifecycle, well, obviously, you want to make sure the testers have done some development in the past. So really do grill the people you're interviewing, not just...
But part of the problem is that the companies don't have the internal skills to effectively interview these people. Well, one of the reasons they're outsourcing it is because they don't know what they're doing.
Right, well, some of the things you could do is ask them for references and also ask them if you can observe their work in progress. And if they start talking about proprietary methodology and magic incantations, whoop! And also, finally, you rotate through vendors. You can't put all your eggs in one basket, even just for availability. You know, people ultimately go on vacation. You need another team to... Yeah, and just kind of...
Yeah, it all depends on the skill of the team. And, you know, what we recommend people do is just make sure that the people they put... You know, it's the old bait and switch. They'll put in five people with extraordinary credentials, and then you will get one of them for part-time, and then they'll bring in a team of 10 other people to do the job. And doing these things at their offices where you're not sure who's doing the work, so you got to get firm accounting of who's working on what, and you got to make sure that you get the people that they put in the...
And I think one of the features that a lot of the consulting companies are giving that most people are not taking advantage of is some form of, like, you know, you're invited to sit in on the testing. So you get two sides of it. One, you get to learn from these people.
Transfer of knowledge.
And second, you can keep an eye on the quality of people you're getting. I mean, if you're getting people who are like 20, you know, nothing against age, but like if you're getting 16, 17,
what is this age thing, man?
I'm just saying, but if, you know, if you're seeing someone who's obviously not qualified for it, you know, there's no better way than take advantage. I think every vendor I know has that, you know, if you ask for it, they might not
have to ask.
There's a very simple answer to this question. If they have a CISSP, they're good to go.
Yeah. All right, let's not get into certifications.
All right,
don't start with me.
I'm still a couple box tops away from my certification. So
actually, what you need to do is, if they're dressed well, get rid of them.
Referrals is also another good way.
And dress as well, make sure
All right. But are there any other questions, or it's time for lunch, folks. I mean, we can. I don't mind sticking around, but you know, the camera's going to be shut off.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.